From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the late 80s, Edie Brickell found fame as lead singer of the New Bohemians. Singing their top 10 hit, What I Am, at 22, she captured the neo-hippie sidestepping of philosophy and religion and made the plea for self-definition that became a hallmark of the Gen X 90s. The New Bohemians didn't survive their second CD, and Edie Brickell moved to a more personal track. She married pop superstar Paul Simon, had three children, and stepped out of the fame game. On Volcano, her first CD in 10 years, Edie Brickell now shares a glimpse of what she is now, with an intimate collection of songs that carry the rootsy rock of her native Texas, along with jazz and blues influences. Volcano tells stories of free spirits and restlessness, but also narrates the satisfaction of sticking around, of going slow, slow enough for marriage, for children, for life. Tonight on Point, Edie Brickell in her own tempo. Good evening and welcome to On Point, Edie Brickell.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. So, where have you been?
I've been at home playing some guitar and taking strolls through Central Park, pushing the stroller, and you name it. Going to the movie sometimes.
It's a great picture. Three kids since you were last out with a solo album.
Mm-hmm. I've never been happier. They made me laugh every single day since the day they were born.
Take us back, Edie Brickell, to, well, if you would, to that whole neo-hippie, new bohemian thing. Where were you when that hurricane hit your life? How did you go from, I guess you were a college student at SMU, Southern Methodist University in Texas, to suddenly What I Am? How did it happen?
Just out of high school, I applied to one college because it was a college in town, and I got accepted to SMU. And then there was a big struggle because the tuition was so great and everything. So there was so much pressure at that age and so much pressure on me to figure out what to do. And how do you decide on a career? And nothing that I could major in at school seemed like anything that would make me happy. And so I got all this financial aid, and I felt unbearable pressure doing that. And I went to school, and I was just struggling because I knew this isn't what I wanted, what I wanted to be. And the only thing that I really had a passion for was music. So luckily I met New Bohemians. I started singing with them, and we were a jam band, and we wrote songs very quickly, and we played in the clubs down in Texas, and we got pretty darn popular and had a nice crowd that kept coming back. And I gave myself 1 year to be in the band. I thought if a record company doesn't come and sign us in a year, then it wasn't meant to be, because I just knew that I needed to do something.
But it did happen. The recording contract came along.
Yeah, and 11 and a half months later, there they were. Geffen Records gave us a contract. But then when the record came out, it was so powerfully big, and I was in such a different place.
This was shooting Rubber Bands at the Stars.
Rubber Bands at the Stars. Yeah, it made me really kind of nervous and embarrassed to be out in public so much. And I felt like as a musician, I hadn't really earned it yet, because there was so much more that I wanted to express, and that was just a funny little beginning. And
it was quite a beginning. Yeah, platinum, went platinum, sold a million copies, the huge single, What I Am. How much of the writing for the New Bohemians was your writing? How much was collective with the group, Edie?
About half and half. We jammed through a lot of songs, and then I would sing songs to them. What I Am was a song that I just sang to him. I was driving in the car on the way over there, sang it to Kenny, and then Kenny, of course, comes up with that incredible guitar lick. So he really carried it, I think, with that groove and made it something very, very special. I know that I was just lucky to be with a band that was so inventive.
Did you think of yourselves at the time as neo-hippies, or was that something plastered on by the studio?
I think that those guys, I guess they were hippies in the sense that they were real deadheads. They were crazy about the Grateful Dead, and I didn't know much about the Grateful Dead until they introduced their music to me. But I came from a different perspective. I came from a soul country background. So it was a nice blend.
You were Texas kids. You certainly were. Grew up there. Single mom, as I read here. Tell us about your early childhood. Where exactly did you grow up? What was the setting?
I was born in Oak Cliff, Texas, in a real old part of Dallas. My parents split When I was really young, my dad was a pro bowler when I was a kid.
A professional bowler?
Yeah, they called him the Fort Worth Southpaw.
All right.
And then they split, and so my mom was a single-working mom. She was a receptionist, and we moved a lot. We lived in a lot of different apartments around Dallas, went to a lot of different schools. So it was a different lifestyle. You know, I watched a woman struggle trying to make ends meet. And that's why I felt a lot of pressure early on in life to change. I didn't want to live that life. I didn't want to struggle or be a part of struggling all the time. I wanted to live a happy, full life. And even though she struggled, though, she was a big music fan, loved music, had a great sense of humor. There was a lot of joy there, but there was a lot of worry about how she could raise her kids.
We can hear that very clearly in the first track on your new album, Volcano. This is called Rush Around from Edie Brickell.
Must have heard the same song 20 times. Mama sang and put the makeup on her eyes. We were getting ready to go. School and work was so blow. Everybody had to rush, rush, rush around. Rush, rush, rush around. Rush, rush, rush around. I remember thinking this just can't be right. Got to be a better way to live your life. Slow, like a soft southern breeze.
There's that rush around that every family knows, and when it's a single mom, you know it even more. I love that lyric, Edie Brickell. I mean, what kid can't think of the mother getting ready? Everybody getting ready, but the mother, you know, putting on the eyeliner or whatever. Listen to the song, it really catches a moment. You're saying, though, that rush around that single mom life was one that you actively did not want to replicate.
I didn't. I wanted, I always thought if I had kids, that I wanted to be able to be there for him, and she wanted to be there for us, but it just didn't, the cards weren't played that way. But it provided an opposite setting for me to idealize about and look forward to. And I aimed to do that. And I wanted to have kids early on in life. Even when my career first happened, I really wanted a family more than I wanted to stay in that career, because when all the fame hit, I felt kind of lonesome out there. And I met people who were legends or had great careers, and I thought that should make them very happy, but I got a sense that alone did not. And so I didn't want to be 60 years old and look back and say, well, I had one heck of a great career, but I didn't have a family.
That's all I had, yeah.
And so I wanted, I knew very early on that I needed that family, and I really wanted it.
And yet, there's a tension in the songs on your new album, including the title track, Volcano, where on the one hand, you've got the nurturing, the mother kind of figure, that more mature voice. On the other hand, you're still very aware of that wild girl motif. Let's listen to the title track, Volcano. You can hear it all over this song.
So young and beautiful in her old used car, and she's had a belly full of the way things are, trying to make ends meet down to her last dollar, burning from the heat of a temple like lava. She's a volcano. Hot, wide,
So there it is, Edie Brickell. Here's that other woman, not the other woman. You sing about that too on this album, but the kind of penniless, on the edge woman in tension, the volcano. Is that still you, or is it an image you keep in mind?
That's not me. That's a lot of the women that I knew growing up. I was sitting playing that little lick one night, late at night, and I had this vivid image come back to me, this memory of this woman in my family, near and dear to me, sitting in this old used car with all her makeup on, looking out the window in the hot Texas sun, no air conditioning. And she looked as beautiful as any movie star, and she just struggled and wanted a better life, but had a rough one. And I knew lots of characters like that growing up.
The world is full of them. Is that something you found yourself running away from? When you look at it now, I mean, you know the kind of yearning that goes on in that young woman's mind that you described, so young and beautiful in her old used car. Is that a yearning, an exposed quality that you want to stay away from?
Well, when I saw that and grew up around that when I was a kid, I thought, if I make the right choices early on and try to live my dreams and not just chase romance or have a family in my teens, then maybe I can avoid it. And I think that, you know, in that Texas culture back then, people basically had kids as a teenager, and then they struggled so much. And I saw that in many generations and knew lots of folks that way and felt like it was just a habit that ought to be broken.
The guy that you ultimately hitched up with was not just any guy. I've read this wonderful description where you were guest singing on Saturday Night Live and following the cameras around the studio there, and your eyes jumped one more hop, skip, and jump, and you were staring at Paul Simon. He became your husband. How did that unfold?
Well, I'll go back to when I was 16, and I just started driving, and I drove over to my friend's house, who was 14 years older than me, and I was flipping through her record collection, and I got to Paul's solo record with that one where he's close-up of his face, and he's got that hood on.
Sure.
And I got this little tingle on the back of my neck. I said, "Who is this gorgeous guy?" To my friend, she said, "That's Paul Simon, you know." And I wasn't familiar with his records because my mom didn't have any of those records, and I didn't really buy records yet. So I checked out the music, and I thought it was incredible. And so I always just thought he was gorgeous. Loved those eyes and that beautiful mouth. And then to get on Saturday Night Live and be confronted with him face to face knocked me out, made me mess up the song on live TV. If you see an old video of it, you see me swirling around to the band saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." And Kenny, the guitarist, just does a big 1, 2, 3 ending. But I talked to him afterwards at the party, and his intelligence and humor just swept me off my feet, and that was it. After I met him, I could think of no one else.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with Edie Brickell.
Let me turn off your TV before you go crazy. Come out for a while with me. No, don't be lazy. Tall trees whose shadows fall along sheep meadow. Never know what we'll see. Come take a walk with me. Well, I know you're weary now and uninspired, but if you stop going out, you'll just grow tired. Tall trees whose shadows fall along sheep's meadow. Never know what we'll see. Come take a walk.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Edie Brickell, whose new CD, Volcano, is her first solo release in a decade. In the background is Ooh La La.
The cover looked like it was flowing, and the candlelight as the music played, and you embraced.
taste of wine was on his lips, straight from the vine to the fingertips of your waist. Ooh, love of my love. A hidden dream since you were a girl, the mystery of a secret world revealed to you. You felt the rise of butterflies, the look of kindness.
Brickell on her new album, Volcano. Edie Brickell, so there you are, married to Paul Simon, three kids, I guess all born during the 90s, and at some point you start accumulating music again. Where did it fit into that decade of mothering and childbirth and diapers and all the rest?
Late at night. I would go in and play guitar and practice the new chords I'd learned and just kept writing. To me, songwriting is my favorite part of making music because it's a mystery and a puzzle that you have to work on. I remember specifically thinking one night, I was lying in bed working out these lyrics, and I thought, look at you, look how lucky you are. You're not worrying about something. I remember thinking back, other people I know lie in bed sometimes, they say, I couldn't sleep, I was worried about this or that. And I'm lying in bed trying to work out a puzzle, a lyric, and I thought that creativity really saves you.
When you're doing that, is it the puzzle of a poem? Is it the puzzle of a song? Is the music already there at that point?
Yeah, the music inspires the lyric. And many times I'll be playing something and the first verse, usually that's what it is, the first verse and chorus will just fly out. And then I'll have to go and puzzle the rest out later. Or sometimes the song just comes out all at once. Like Volcano was just a specific image that I basically felt like I was narrating. Like little movies come into my mind and they're easy. They're all right there. And then other times I feel like I pretty much said it in the first person chorus, so I have to figure out then what. And that's really fun.
But it's impressive in this realm of music. You look in the liner notes and the lyrics are very, very brief. And yet these songs, we know it very well. In your hands, in Paul Simon's hands, and so many artists, they create a whole universe. What makes a song pop up in that way?
I think what I relate to with other songwriters is if I get a sense that it's something that they've actually experienced, or if they've trusted their imaginations and let it just flow out, then it's attractive to me. Then I really connect with it. And I hope that that's what I can do. That's the puzzle of it. You trust what flows out at first, and then you just sort of build on it. I don't know. It is mysterious, and you just hope you get it right, and you hope that you can remain interested.
I studied long ago with a writer who said, as long as what you unleash is absolutely honest, no matter how bizarre or dark or strange it may seem, many other people will relate to it, as long as it's honest.
You know what? I think I learned that recently from Hank Williams. I checked out his CD or a bunch of songs, and I was so moved and touched by it, and I thought, you know, that's the way. You got to trust your life and the experiences that you've been given and trust your love of music and just go with it. And I didn't feel like I had to express it like some other songwriter or try to be like some of my favorites. Just trust what you got and see if you can be any good at it.
And what about that honesty part? I wonder if you think relationships can cut artists off from expressing certain sentiments. I mean, do you self-censor, I don't know, some line of sentiment thinking, oh, geez, Paul Simon might find that pretty strange if he knew I was thinking that. Better not make a song out of that one.
No, there are a couple of songs on this record where I think I've thought that and I just let them go anyway.
two songwriters in the family. I mean, he can be right back at you. Let's listen to another track from Edie Brickell's new CD, first one out in a decade. This is Came a Long Way.
I came a long way for your love.
Burkell, tell us about being a Texas girl. Girl no more, but a Texas girl born and raised in New York City.
Well, it's pretty interesting because you see so many different kinds of people. I really always loved Central Park, going through Central Park. But Central Park saved me, too, because I really missed the trees and the pastoral scenes in Texas. So it's a funny mix, you know, but I like all the creative people up here. I like them a lot. I admire the people who have been strong enough and creative enough to make it on their own in New York City. Because you gotta be pretty smart to do that.
You know what Frank Sinatra said, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. But do you miss Texas? Does Central Park really double for that Texas panhandle and the rest?
Well, I get to go back home a lot, and I visit a lot. And when I go there, I love seeing my family, and I love being there. But I like coming home, too. I like having changed and made a life here. So I get the best of both worlds, you know? You know what I really miss are the big grocery stores.
You mean the ones in Texas?
Yeah.
That go on for acres?
Yeah, they're fantastic. I mean, they're all squinched up here. You know?
Right.
If somebody sneezes, you feel like, oh, it's on me or on my food.
Right.
But there, you know, you can cruise and even turn your cart around in a big wide circle. It's fantastic.
And what about motherhood? I know you write late at night when the kids are in bed, but do you find it a source for your art? Do you want to sing about being a mother? Do you want to sing about raising children? Or do you think, well, that's not commercial, or that's not really what I want to sing about?
You know what? I think that it hasn't come into my creative mind yet. I think creatively, I'm sort of in my 20s. In that creatively, I'm still dealing with memories from growing up in Texas. And that my real life hasn't caught up to my creative life yet.
Hmm.
It takes a while, I think, for it to be absorbed in your soul and mind.
I wonder if there's really, I mean, in some ways, you're drawing a new model here. You walked away from the fame very deliberately to be a wife and mother and still a musician, but you put that down to some large extent. I wonder if pop music allows for songs about motherhood, or is it just too, you know, sappy?
I think it depends on how you do it. I guess if I was interested in writing a song about motherhood, that I would do my best to make it anything but sappy. And I think you could make, you know what I'm interested in, mm-hmm. is making a very fun children's record. Paul and I are both interested in that. In fact, we recorded one song I used to sing to the kids all the time. We recorded it together to see, you know, maybe it's just the beginning. Because we want to do something that's just, you know, fun and spirited and has the kind of sense of humor that we share with our kids, as opposed to put your arms up, touch your toes,
right.
turn around, hit your nose.
Right, right.
What is that?
Well, that's a kid's song as we've known it. Do you like to perform with Paul? Do you do it much at all?
No, just around the house with our kids. Just
with the PJs on.
Just trying to, yeah, just playing with the kids.
Let's listen to another cut from Edie Burkell's new CD, Volcano. This is What Would You Do?
Barely old enough to legally drive. She took off in her stepmother's van. A restlessness that blew her over the line. Like the wind inside an aluminum can. At a payphone in a donut shop, she called her friend back home. We're all worried and they've called the cops. Are you crazy? Where have you gone? She said, what would you do if you
suicide to stay and murder to leave? That's a pretty great line, Edie. What was that one after you put the kids to bed?
You know what? That was the last 2 days of recording. I got up, and the kids weren't there. I got up in New York City just before going over to the studio in Brooklyn, and I was just playing guitar, and that song just flowed out all at once, and I took it in and played it for Charlie, and he said, let's record this today. So that's just an incredible moment for me, a real gratifying moment, because I always wanted to capture an energy and a spirit of a song as it's just written. And I've only done that one other time with a song called Baby that I recorded with New Bohemians, and it's on a collection. That song was recorded. I was singing it to the kids outside, and I went over and woke up the New Bohemians that were staying at our guest house in Montauk. I said, let's go record this song. Let's do it. And that was written and recorded within an hour.
Fresh and out of the oven, that one.
Yeah, it has just a great energy to it. And then the next time I got to do it was with this one here, this What Would You Do? And the spirit of the song really lives when you get to record it just after having written it.
But here comes back that kind of bad girl or lost girl. It makes me think of Edie Brickell at 22 going over the moon with that first album. Now you're writing, 10, 15 years on? You're 37 now. Do you feel yourself writing from a different place? Are you very consciously a more mature songwriter now?
Yeah, I am. I mean, my kids made me get a little more serious about it because I thought, if they're going to hear it, you know, I need to express who I really am as opposed to what I think is kind of cool and what I think will make the band laugh or just moving along with the band or going along with the flow. It made me define my tastes and represent who I am in hopes that when they get older, they'll feel comfortable to represent themselves as who they really are, as opposed to bouncing off of every person or idea that floats around in their pop culture or their society.
What about other artists? Who do you listen to? Who have you, if you have, modeled yourself on? Who do you listen to now?
Now I'm checking out Rufus Wainwright. I really love his new record a lot, like his past record. He inspires me to become a better musician. And I love the Del McCoury band. I love that grassroots sound. I'm crazy about early Duke Ellington and Django Reinhardt. I was a big fan of, I'm still a big fan, but I was really a great fan of Bjork about 10 years back for her Post record. I thought, I loved how original her lyrics are, and I thought that her accent and her voice has its own musical quality that I'm a little bit jealous of.
who wouldn't be? And here I'm reading in the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I wonder what you make of this. They say she sings like a blithe, spirited Tammy Wynette, at certain times a more reflective Janis Joplin. Do you welcome that kind of comparison? Do you understand what they're talking about or not, Edie Brickell?
No, I don't. Yeah, I don't mind. I don't mind as long as they feel fit to talk about it. That's okay with me. Yeah, any comparison, however people hear it. I mean, we all hear things differently. I just hope that it's good.
You reached out to Charlie Sexton to produce this album with you, a fellow Texan, a guitar sideman for Bob Dylan. Unpack that process of a songwriter putting her songs and her talent in the hands of a producer here. What did Charlie bring to the process?
Charlie brought a spirit of a live band and not changing the songs. He kept true to the demos. And I mean, in the past, I'd worked with producers who we went through grueling pre-production where you play the songs over and over and over and over in a rehearsal space. And then by the time you went into the studio to cut them, the spirit of the song was lost. You were sick of it. The energy's gone. Charlie comes up. We listen to the song once in the booth. The band goes out. We play it twice. We come in and say, well, that's it. We got it. The first take. So he captured an energy and a vibe that I've always wanted to get down on tape and never felt like I was going to ever be able to do or ever done. I thought that was like the lost art of recording.
The demo would be just you with your guitar.
Yeah, very much like the beginning of Volcano.
He's bringing an awful lot of color, of a big envelope to surround that. It could be shocking if it wasn't what you expected.
No, it was absolutely gorgeous what he does. He understood, he intuited the music perfectly. I mean, he just got it. And when he first sent up, like my manager said I needed a producer, I said I didn't really want a producer because I didn't want somebody to make a more commercial sounding record for me. He sent the demos down to Charlie. Charlie sent up Volcano with his treatment on it. He played all over it. When I heard it, I was blown away.
So you sent down the naked demo, and back it comes with his treatment right around your recording.
And it sounds very much exactly like what you hear on this record.
That must be an incredible experience to hear it come back. Like, now it's got the heart of you and then all this living color around it.
Yeah, and Charlie plays cello on it and violin on it. He's an incredible musician. He's so musical that it makes you kind of crazy and excited. And he just hears everything. So his layers were emotional and well played.
Lucky to work with. We're talking tonight with Edie Brickell, the former New Bohemian, who's now making her own music. We're going to take a short break, but first, let's hear The Messenger from Edie Brickell's new CD, Volcano. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I know you've tried very hard in your life to be kind. When love has died, you have held on stronger for the other guy. People have changed very little since you've been alive, but you have grown to see them more with your heart than your eyes can fail to give the right portrayal. Was a bird behind a tree, gave me a mind to feel better, he said. Just because you cannot see doesn't mean that it isn't there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Edie Brickell, who's out with a new collection of songs after a 10-year break from making music. We're listening to Once in a Blue Moon.
She said I tried to mind my own business, but that sad look on your face was a challenge to my faith. Made me want to chase the dark out of your room. So she smiled and said hello. Little did she know he would take hold of her soul and never, never, never let go. He was fine.
Edie, you took your hiatus. You're back after about a decade, a lot of mothering and child rearing and being the wife along the way and from all signs loving it. But now you've got an album out again. Does that make you feel like, ooh, I'm back in the game. I've got to prove it all over again.
No, because I'm so busy at home, running up to the school all the time, that I'm completely distracted with a real life. I'm excited to be able to be creative again and make a record, and I really want it to do well. Because to me, this is the real beginning. I feel like I had some false starts along the way as far as a true expression, but a nice career, if that makes any sense. But I feel like this feels like the first true expression, so that means so much to me. But like I say, I'm really busy going to book fairs and parent-teacher conferences, going up and down the road to the school all the time, that I don't have that much time to think about it.
Some people must think, well, gosh, I mean, she's married to Paul Simon. He's huge. She doesn't even have to work. Do you get that?
No, people don't say that. But, yeah, it's not have to work. It's want to. I thought maybe that I could leave music, but I'm sort of infected with it and can't really leave it. And I feel really lucky that I get to make records. I'm really happy that Jolene Cherry from Universal came along and said, you know, I love this record, I want to put it out. And I understand what your life is at home, so, you know, you don't have to do everything, you don't have to jump through all the hoops, but we want to put the record out and help you express the music that you're making now. And to have that is unbelievable, and it's an incredible outlet. And then I don't suffer from empty nest syndrome because I have something to do when my kids are at school, and it's the thing that I most love expressing is music.
You've added guitar to your repertoire and put, it sounds like, a lot of work into that from what we hear on the new CD, Volcano. It sounds great. How did you pick that up?
Well, I met Howard Morgan through Paul's brother, Eddie Simon. Howard's just this buoyant jazz musician. He's an older guy, but he would come in and say, check this out, you got to learn this, check this out. And he was really patient with me because I couldn't always practice, you know, from week to week because of my other duties and schedule. But I continued to be disciplined about playing because I was so frustrated with not being able to express what I hear. And I wanted to play with other musicians and I wanted to become a great musician. So I stuck with it and kept working at it. And I would just take the information that I learned and write new songs with it. So that's what's reflected on this record.
I'm glad you did. Want to listen to a little bit of The One Who Went Away. It's a song about the other woman. And in the end, a sympathetic song, Edie Brickell. Is that right?
Yeah.
Let's hear it. The One Who Went Away.
Out on the moor, he met his lover and knew with grass up to her knees. And there he swore he loved no word. Then he came running home to me. And will she cry all night? And will she cry all day? And will she cry all night? Just for the one who went away. Out on the moor, she's waiting. She's like a wolf under the moon. And I am sighing here beside him. He's right behind me, lying spoons. And will she cry all night? And will she cry all day? And will she cry all night? Just for the one who went away.
Take us in to this song. It describes, more or less, from the vantage of a wife, describing. It sounds like her husband. He finds another woman. It's about the other woman. And at the end of this song, the narrator switches places and goes out to become that wolf on the moor herself, to become maybe the other woman.
Yeah. Again, I was just up late one night, and I came up with that little ding, 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 ding. And all of a sudden, the images just started flowing. I saw this moor and this woman in the grass up to her knees, and that song came out all at once, and I don't really understand where it came from or why. I think the music, that line, just inspired this whole little movie. I went and recorded it basically with that single line playing all the way through, and Charlie liked it a lot. He said, you know, that's really different, and it was fun to have another musician interested in a simple song. And he did that incredible production on it. So it's just a lot of fun working with Charlie. I'm not really used to a musician hearing songwriting. I think he's special in that way. I mean, so many times working with a band, they never really paid attention to the song or the lyrics. Even years later, they would say, let's play that song, you know, that goes da-da-da-da-da, I heard,
right.
You know. And they, or they would repeat the wrong lyric back to me. It would just crack me up. But Charlie actually hears the images and appreciates them, so...
Edie Brickell, what's next? Are you back on the album a year train now?
No. I don't think so. Well, you never know. I mean, if the music's there, but I hope that I look back on this record, which is my favorite right now, and that I think I finally made a record that I love, but I hope one day I look back at it and say, ah, that was nothing.
Right, I was just getting started.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for the new album, Edie Brickell. Thanks for being
Thank
with
you.
Us.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
Edie Brickell, her new album is Volcano. We'll leave you with Not Saying Goodbye. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Give me something to remember you, honey. Hold me close, no, I don't want your money. Leave a sign along the midnight highway. Shine a light to see that I might find my way. I'm not saying goodbye.
In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
These safeguard measures have now achieved their purpose. And as a result of changed economic circumstances, it is time to lift them. The U.S. steel industry wisely used the 21 months of breathing space we provided.
I think the president broke his promise. He let us down. I think the president should be more concerned with the American worker and not the WTO.
It came under small arms and rocket-propelled grenade fire from multiple directions. The fire was determined to be coming from the windows and roofs of nearby buildings, as well as from alleyways and from nearby vehicles.
Maybe one or two or five or ten men attack him, but the big people in the street and in the house and the cities not have fire gun.
Not one single NATO member here today, or including the new countries that are about to become members of the alliance, spoke against the possibility of an expanded role for NATO in Iraq.
A choice lies before all of us. We can take the path of peace detailed in this document, or we can choose sham solutions that would only entrench injustice and insecurity.
Officials in Russia's emergency situations ministry have now confirmed that a bomb ripped through a commuter train near the war-wracked region of Chechnya. These trains tend to be quite crowded, especially early in the morning.
The officer is backing off from Mr. Jones. In fact, he's telling Mr. Jones to back away. The officer is retreating, and Mr. Jones actually lunges at him and attempts to strike him.
He was not threatening anybody or doing anything like that. He was not engaged in any activity to justify them trying to arrest him prior to you seeing that tape come on.
And there's a week President Bush revokes the tariffs on imported steel that he imposed 2 years ago, avoiding a possible trade war with Europe and Asia. He let his spokesman, Scott McClellan, break the news. U.S. forces say they killed 54 Iraqis in response to an ambush in the central Iraqi city of Samarra. But the American version of what transpired differed greatly from stories told by Iraqi locals. Secretary of State Colin Powell calls on NATO allies to consider a more active role in the rebuilding of Iraq. The so-called Geneva Accord is signed in Switzerland, the non-binding agreement, hammered out by self-appointed Israeli and Palestinian negotiators, addresses many of the issues that have been barriers to peace in the Middle East. A suicide bomber kills at least 41 on a Russian train car near Chechnya today, and a Cincinnati man is beaten to death by police during a struggle, reigniting the racial tensions that flared 3 years ago when another African-American man was shot by police in Cincinnati. And there we are, Jack. Another week comes to an end, and much rolling on,
and really big development up here in New Hampshire. The two polls out yesterday showing Governor Dean with a 30-point lead now over John Kerry. And indeed, it shows Kerry, Dean at 45%. One shows him Kerry at 13 and Clark at 11. And so now it looks as if John Kerry is not so much in a race for first place as for second against General Clark.
And a deep second at that.
And a deep, deep second.
You see that as a victory for Dean in the making here, or a failure for Kerry?
Well, yeah, I guess you'd have to say both of them, wouldn't you? I mean, you can't take anything away from Dean, the kind of organization he's had up here. And it was always going to be a race here because of Dean's being from Vermont. Nevertheless, the Kerry collapse is extraordinary, if it holds true. And, you know, looking at, you don't have to be a genius to find the reason why. John Kerry voted for this war resolution. He voted against the first Gulf War, that, you know, President Bush's father. That war was provoked by an overt invasion of Kuwait. That war had international support from the United Nations, from the Arab nations. Mm. That war was going to be paid for by the world. He voted against that, and yet he voted for this one that had no provocation, that the world was not going to pay for, that we were going to have to fight all on our own. So you have to wonder why. And it seems to me it's pretty clear that the reason is that he wanted to run for president in 1992, and along with Richard Gephardt, who also wanted to run, who also voted for this war, he couldn't because he had been on the wrong side of a popular war.
And he wasn't going to be on the wrong side again. But now it looks like he's falling. There's Howard Dean, who absolutely opposed the war and famously and sort of planted his flag there. It's going to draw a very stark line, if that's the matchup, between Dean and Bush. Couldn't be starker.
oh, it couldn't be starker. And, you know, people are saying this could be dangerous for the Democrats, and you hear all the rest of that.
And, Jack, you've been watching Washington as well.
Oh, kind of an odoriferous week, a possible bribery on the floor of the House that helped the Medicare bill, prescription drug bill, get through. A member was approached. Someone said, we can get you $100,000 for your son's campaign to succeed you, or we can spend that money against you, but you've got to vote for this bill. Norman Ornstein, he didn't in the end. Norman Ornstein, a very careful observer, says by every standard, this was a violation of the law.
Sounds like business as usual, almost.
Almost. And you know what? It isn't going to be investigated. Oh, wait a minute. The Justice Department will look at it. But aside from that, there'll be no ethics investigation because there's a truce between the Democrats and the Republicans. I don't look into your bad guys. You don't look into mine. And the only people who lose... public. Richard Perle, he got a $20 million investment from Boeing in his venture capital fund, and then as a member of the Defense Policy Board, lobbied for the $18 billion tanker contract for Boeing. And then we have Pete Domenici, who stuffed an item in the energy bill that was filibustered in the Senate. Complicated, but basically it would give a company that wants to put a uranium enrichment plant in New Mexico, it would essentially, the federal government would pay for the nuclear wastes, which would be about $500 million. This was put in by a member of his staff who had been a lobbyist for that company just last year. It's a European country. It wasn't a European company. It wasn't identified in the bill. Just a little piece of business as usual in the Capitol.
A little stuffing for the Christmas stockings.
Yeah.
Jack, keep that sharp eye out and have a great weekend. Thanks for being with us.
All right, thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.